This is the BBC.
This podcast is supported by advertising outside the UK.
I'm Sumi Somaskandar from the Global Story podcast, where we're asking how the US election could impact the war in Ukraine. With Kamala Harris and Donald Trump neck and neck in the polls, President Zelensky's campaign to ensure crucial funds don't run out is increasingly uncertain. So will the result in November change his nation's fate? The Global Story brings you unique perspectives from BBC journalists around the world. Find us wherever you get your podcasts.
Hello, I'm Sean Lay. Thanks for downloading the BBC's World Tonight podcast from Friday, the 18th of October. After the death of Hamas leader Yahya Sinwar, the British Prime Minister says Israel must stop what he calls excuses and allow aid to reach Gazans. The top official in Gaza from the UN's Office for Humanitarian Affairs tells us what needs to change. The son of the jailed Hong Kong democracy campaigner Jimmy Lai on why he's concerned by the Foreign Secretary David Lammy's visit to Beijing. Broadcaster Mariella Frostrop on being appointed the government's advisor on menopause employment. How lost pride has driven poorer Americans towards Donald Trump and what the Democratic Party should do about it. And as hot sauce sales boom, a hot sauce virgin is rendered speechless. Sir Keir Starmer and the other European leaders who met with President Biden in Berlin earlier today are shedding no tears over the killing of Yahya Sinwar, the leader of Hamas. If they hoped that his elimination had removed an obstacle to a ceasefire, neither side in the conflict appears to see it that way. Hamas released a video message which confirmed its leader's death and also said there would be no ceasefire and no release of the hostages kidnapped as part of its bloody assault on Israel a year ago. Although Sinwar was tracked and killed in Rafah in the south of the Gaza Strip, the Israeli Defence Forces, the IDF, are focused on the north. An Israeli airstrike on a school sheltering displaced people in central Gaza yesterday killed at least 28, including women and children. Israel says it was also being used as a command and control centre by Hamas, and it's ordered people to leave three hospitals in the area. Civilians are also suffering from a slowdown in humanitarian aid. Israel says it's allowed 30 trucks of aid into northern Gaza today, but speaking in Berlin, Sir Keir Starmer issued this warning.
The dire humanitarian situation cannot continue. And I say once again to Israel, the world will not tolerate any more excuses on humanitarian assistance. Civilians in northern Gaza need food now.
Aid workers say suffering is most acute in the sprawling Jabalia refugee camp. Georgios Petropoulos heads the team at the UN Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs in Gaza. He spoke to me earlier from Rafah.
There's upwards of 400,000 people in northern Gaza, of which upwards of 100,000 are in Jabalia. These people right now have no access to food and very little water left. The health system there has collapsed. And as we have seen over more than a year here, civilians, especially children, are bearing the brunt here. You'll recall that we have had no food supplies enter the north in early October. And even in the last few days, when food has begun to enter from northern crossings, we only got about 12 trucks of flour after those two closed weeks. And that's only enough for about less than 10,000 families. So we really need safe, quick, sustained and unimpeded access to these people, or we're going to see a massive death.
The Israeli government would argue that the reason that Jabalia is besieged in this way is because it has been used by members of Hamas. It's in a sense, because it's a vast city, it's a place where people can hide.
I mean, there's many places where people can hide. In the case of an urban setting, there's laws of war and there's ways that you prosecute that war. Punishing the people of Jabalia that simply live there is not the way to do it.
In terms of the aid question, I'm going to put to you what a US congressman said to me earlier in the week, a congressman from Joe Biden's Democratic Party. He said there is aid. It's just being stolen by Hamas.
We don't really know who's stealing the aid. There's armed men and they're taking the aid.
So it is being stolen. Somebody is taking it.
Yeah, not all of it, but a large amount of aid that will come through the one crossing that we're allowed to use in the most dangerous part of southern Gaza. Yes, it is at very, very high risk of looting by by criminals. I've been here a while. I've seen people stop trucks earlier this year simply because they were hungry. We'd let them stop the trucks and take the flour 1 kilometer before the distribution site. And that was a different thing. This is people actually letting the flour go through and taking high-value items, which are later actually sold back to the people. So, you know, the implication of Hamas taking it, fine. We can't really be sure about who it is and why they take it. Our concern, the damage it's doing to the civilians here is that instead of getting a free tent, you are using money you don't have and putting your household further in debt to buy now a tent that was stolen because for months, the negotiations that we've made, the requests that we're making to the government of Israel to enable some kind of rule of law in Gaza goes unheard. So while we still have this inability to get food and supplies through Kerem Shalom, why not open any number of other crossings in areas that are not under evacuation orders? Rafah Governorate is a war zone. Why take all of the aid for almost 2 million people through a war zone, which is essentially no man's land? For me, it makes no sense.
Prime Minister Netanyahu is, in a sense, saying, actually, this is killing someone as a vindication of what we did when we went into Rafah. We were told it there was a risk of kind of calling humanitarian problems there, but it allowed us to kind of get the man who has been organising Hamas, and therefore, actually, that is a justification for what we are doing.
From our side here in southern Gaza, the last 3 days we spent on the polio campaign. We vaccinated hundreds of thousands of children in the middle part of Gaza. From tomorrow, we will begin in the south. It's just a good example of what we can do when we are facilitated to do so. We can help so many hundreds and millions and hundreds of thousands of millions of people here if we simply have our hands untied.
But isn't the problem you can't do that and have a military operation at the same time? Even the best organized and the best intentioned government or country couldn't achieve those two things simultaneously.
The secret that maybe apparently is very difficult for us to get out, failing actually having international journalists here, to be quite frank with you, is that most of the Gaza Strip does not have military operations. The Rafah Governorate, half of it has military operations. And the North Gaza government has military operations. The rest of the Gaza Strip is either under constant airstrikes from here or there, or has evacuation orders cutting us off from going there. But where there are evacuation orders does not mean that there's active fighting. For months, most of Gaza east of the Saladin Road is simply deserted, and we don't understand why. We can't either use it for more displacement sites or to reach warehouses and wash, water pumps and bakeries that we could actually utilize. That's a question for the Israeli government.
Georgios Petropoulos from the UN's Humanitarian Affairs team in Gaza. Well, the hopes among Western leaders that Israel will seize the opportunity of Yahya Sinwar's death to scale down military operations depend upon Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. He's insisted the war is not over. And speaking to our colleagues on the BBC World Service, Cabinet Minister Amichai Chikli suggested the military operation needed to continue.
We had clear goals for the war in Gaza: to bring back the hostages, to eliminate Hamas' military capabilities, and to make sure that Hamas is also political ineffective and cannot govern Gaza in the future.
Well, Dan Meridor served as Minister of Finance under Benjamin Netanyahu in the 1990s and later as his Deputy Prime Minister. He's since become a critic of the Prime Minister's shift further to the right. Mr. Meridor is now President of the Israel Council on Foreign Relations. Dan Meridor, welcome to The World Tonight. Thank you very much for talking to us. Do you regard the death of Yahya Sinwar as in any way an opportunity for Israel?
Well, you know, Yahya Sinwar was the head of Hamas that attacked us over a year ago in the most barbaric way, killing over 1,000 civilians, kidnapping, raping, unheard of things that by surprise, years after we have left Gaza altogether, we were not occupying Gaza anymore. And of course, there should have been a response. And the death of Sinwar some days ago was a very important step in that very tough campaign. Now, definitely when there's war in areas that is full of people, densely populated, it's very tough. It's tough because innocent people are killed or wounded, and this is tragic all the time. The question is, what do you do? We don't do say what the British did to the Germans by bombing civilian populations intentionally. But if people hide there, what do you do? I'm not in the government now, and I can't speak for the government, but I can say that, as far as I know, there's a lot of effort not to hit or not to cause damage to people who are not involved,
but even
shouldn't
if
be hit.
But
in fact, in times of war, these things happen. I thought that the death of Sinwa could be a turning point.
Right, and that's the point I wanted to get at. When you said turning point, should the Prime Minister be doing with that, and what is he not doing?
If I were him, I would try to say, okay, this was a tough campaign. The chief architect of this massacre is hit by us. He's no more there. I would have said I'm ready to stop all hostilities, all acts of war, in return of the release of the hostages. They still have 101 people, hopefully most of them still alive, whom they don't want to release. And if they would accept, I would stop all hostilities in return to returning the hostages home alive. And then I would even say, if that is the case, I would call for restoration of these devastated areas of Gaza,
right,
with the help of Saudis, Emirates, Egyptians, and others, to allow another civilian rule over Gaza, not Hamas. I think this could have been a turning point.
But the reality is that he couldn't do that, could he? Because if he did that, people in his cabinet would pull out and the government would collapse.
Well, you know, I hope not, but maybe. So what is this? What do I say here? If the Prime Minister thinks I'm right, I'm not sure he does, he should do it. If the cost is that the government is in trouble, the government's in trouble. You don't do things for coalition. You hope coalitions to have the right policy. It's a critical minute. I'm not sure there is a way to do it now because it's tough. But I think that this could have been a turning point. In a way, we won this very awful battle that we were forced to have by the killing of Sinwar and other chief executives and commanders of these terror organizations. And I think this is time to put an end to it on one condition, that all the people kidnapped are brought back home. And now the government should not collapse. If it collapses, so what? I mean, this could not be the ultimate reason not to do things because the government is there. I'm not sure that's the case, but if that's the case, it's not the right thing to do.
Dan Meridol, former Deputy Prime Minister and Minister of Finance in Israel. Thanks very much for joining.
I'm Lucy Hawkins from the Global Story podcast, where we're looking at disinformation online and its potential influence on the upcoming US presidential election. Why people fall for online conspiracy theories and what happens when real-world events are shaped by online disinformation, and how AI could affect the result of next month's election. The Global Story brings you unique perspectives from BBC journalists around the world. Find us wherever you get your podcasts.
Here, the government is promising further reforms of welfare as part of efforts to get people back into work and to cut public spending. One group who can be vulnerable to losing their jobs are women in the menopause. Workers get parental leave and even compassionate leave for bereavement, but plenty of employers show little sympathy for women's menopausal symptoms. Today, the government's appointed the television and radio presenter Mariella Frostrop, who chairs the campaign group Menopause Mandate, as its new ambassador on menopause employment. I've been speaking to Mariella and also to Karen Farquharson, who successfully sued her employer for harassment and unfair dismissal over her menopause symptoms. Karen began by telling me what changed for her when she started going through the menopause.
My whole life changed. I had been with my employer for 27 and a half years. And I just got treated terribly when I started going through menopause.
And the symptoms that you were experiencing, do you think they significantly affected you in terms of as an employee?
Of course it did. I was like a different person. Brain fog, anxiety, crippling pain, sporadic bleeding. I just felt my whole life had changed.
Mariella, I wanted to ask you about taking on this job as the government's advisor on the menopause. Why have you agreed to do this? Is it partly informed by your own experience and the experience of other women you know?
Well, my campaigning around menopause was totally informed by my own experience, which was that I stepped into it in total ignorance, of which I'm not proud. But I think that echoes the experience of an awful lot of women, and I'm suspect Karen will probably say the same thing. And I think it's really interesting, you know, and upsetting to hear what she went through, because actually there's so many swirling misnomers and mythology around menopause. But the fact of the matter is that 97% of women, we just did the biggest survey ever of peri and menopausal women in the UK at Menopause Mandate, and 97% of women said that they experienced symptoms. And what's interesting is, you know, menopause is synonymous with the hot flush, you know, and everyone makes jokes about it. And, you know, that's when you're supposedly, when you know you're menopausal and that's it, then you're sort of supposed to shuffle off and die, I think. But actually, what's much more debilitating are the symptoms that more women experience. So you've got 84% of women who have the leading symptom is brain fog, as Karen just said. Anxiety is just about 81% of women. And these are things that, you know, are difficult to talk about at the best of times. But when they're connected to a period in women's life that has been pretty much just the subject of derisory jokes from stand-up comedians, and other than that, very little discussed at all, you can see that it creates a really toxic environment that makes, you know, for figures like I can quote you today, 60,000 women leaving the workforce every year because of lack of support during this transitional phase, and costing the economy £1.5 billion. You know, it makes no economic sense at all to allow that to continue.
Karen, what was the response of your employer, the person, the company you'd worked for, as you say, for more than a quarter of a century, when your body was going through a stage over which you don't have any control?
I wasn't believed, and I would have to work from home when I was suffering rather than travel in a car. And I wasn't believed that I was actually working from home either. I gave that company 110% and they didn't believe me. And it all came to a head in December 2022.
Now, you won your claim for unfair dismissal, blatant discrimination against you. What would you hope that somebody like Mariella can bring to this job, can sort of tell government?
It's education. It's grassroots education, and to get specifically male employers on board and to listen to their female employees, nurture them, give them the flexibility that they need and the support that they need.
Mariella, you've talked about a phrase about, I think, menowashing. What does that mean?
Well, I think that there are a lot of firms who talk the talk when it comes to menopause and having menopause policies. But when push comes to shove, they tend to be a little bit flimsy. But I think that with new policies like flexible working as default, I think that's going to reduce the burden on working mothers. And I think that all of the conversation around this now, and also, of course, the fact that the Equality Act 2010 protects workers against discrimination and menopause is now included in that. I think that the steps are being taken in the right direction. And for me, the important thing is that it's understood that this is about women's entire biological journey, which impacts detrimentally on their earning capacity at various stages in their life. The working world is built on a sort of Victorian model, if you will. Men go out to work, they get paid for it, and they get power and status. And women stay at home and work at home and get no power and no status. And of course, we know that's changed. And we're very much a fixture in the workplace now, and an economic imperative in terms of the nation's economy. So what we need to do is create a collegiate, collaborative workspace that looks after all employees and actually doesn't discriminate against women when they're going through what are perfectly natural periods of their lives, whether it's during the time that they're, you know, making babies and having to take maternity leave and so on, or onto menopause. Because I think that what needs to happen is all of this needs to now be understood as part of how workplaces need to include women. And, you know, the minute that gets recognised, then change will happen.
The last government did quite a lot on this. Do you think we're moving in the right direction, Mariella?
I think the last government talked quite a lot about this, but actually, I think when it comes to women's experience, you know, you're talking about something around 32% of companies now have menopause policies. I'm not feeling grateful at the moment. But I do feel that the winds of change are blowing very hard. And we do have a government who, part of my job will be holding them to account in terms of, you know, what they put in place for women going through this, as I say, liminal phase, and just needs a little bit of clever and creative thinking around.
And on clever and creative thinking, do you think companies, big and small, make enough use of older women employees who've already gone through this to help those women who are suffering, as Karen suffered?
Really, it's we have to dig even deeper than that, because as Karen said, the biggest problem we have at the moment is a lack of understanding across the board, women themselves. So you can't expect male employers or male partners. You know, we're starting really at the baseline and we need to build from there.
New menopause employment advisor Mariella Frostrup with Karen Farquharson. Coming up on The World Tonight, what's behind the dramatic boom in the sale of hot sauces? I'll be experiencing a live taste test. So this may be a slightly shorter edition of The World Tonight than normal. We'll find out. First, though, David Lammy, the Foreign Secretary, has been in Beijing today meeting his Chinese opposite number. He's aiming to improve relations, which in turn the government hopes will boost trade and encourage foreign investment, even though the two countries see the world very differently.
I believe we can strengthen dialogue and cooperation between us in a way that is consistent, respectful, and in both of our long-term interests. There are, of course, areas where we have different perspectives. I hope we can find space to discuss such areas constructively.
Well, one difference that was raised in that meeting by Mr. Lammy is the detention and prosecution of Jimmy Lai, publisher of the pro-democracy paper Apple Daily. A British citizen, he's been incarcerated in Hong Kong for 4 years and is facing trial for breaching its national security law. There's no indication, though, that the Chinese were willing to discuss the case. Sebastian Lai, Jimmy's son, wanted to speak to Mr. Lammy before his visit to China, but has yet to be offered the opportunity. When Sebastian came into the World Tonight studio, I asked him about the conditions Jimmy Lai is held in.
He is in a maximum security prison. He is almost 77 now. He has been in solitary confinement for almost 4 years. What is happening to him is nothing short of torture. He gets 50 minutes of exercise a day. Given his advanced age and his diabetes, his health has, as you can expect, gotten much worse. He has had a number of spurious charges leveled against him. Now he has his national security law trial. That was just, they paused it in the middle for 6 months, which is highly unusual. But the maximum sentence for that is life. But even if he gets 5 years, 10 years, I mean, his health has gotten much worse. So I don't know how much longer he has. So it's definitely urgent.
And this is, in a sense, the key point, isn't it, from your point of view of the what you were hoping the British government would do when the Foreign Secretary talked to the Chinese. And in a statement today, the Foreign Office says it raised the case of Jimmy Lai. The words it uses are that the implementation of the national security law and the ongoing treatment of British national Jimmy Lai, again calling for his release. It's not the first time they've called for his release. There is a limit, isn't it, in truth, to what they can do and indeed whether the Chinese will even listen.
Yeah, there is, which is why calling for his release is obviously incredibly important and it's a great first step. But the UK government has to be much more robust. They have to take it up as a whole governmental issue. Because in the end, the freedoms that my father fought for and defended in Hong Kong are freedoms that we all believe in. So I think any dialogue with the Chinese should start with, if you're not going to respect, if you're going to essentially kill a citizen for fighting for the beliefs that we all believe in, that you say in Hong Kong you still have, then how can we have any dialogue? How can we have a normalization of relationship?
One other phrase they use in the news release, the feedback out of the meeting between David Lammy and the Chinese foreign minister in Beijing today, is it is a necessity that the UK and China increase bilateral engagements. And that's obviously much beyond the question of human rights, but because of the concerns about the war in Ukraine, about trade and investment. I mean, you understand that, don't you? Your father's case, it's terrible. It has to be put in the context of all of that.
Yeah, of course, 100%. And nobody's saying you shouldn't trade with China. I mean, we've run a huge trade deficit with China, so, you know, we buy a lot of stuff from them. But nobody trades out of goodness of the heart. And we have to make it very clear that we're not willing to sell a ounce of the dignity of the people of the United Kingdom. And we're not going to let any state, no matter how powerful, tell us what we can or cannot say about our citizens, who we can or cannot defend.
But China's not stopping us saying that he shouldn't be in prison. It can't stop us doing
that. Well, they actually, it was only after actually Lord Cameron that they have called for his immediate and unconditional release.
So previous governments hadn't.
Yeah, so you do see some pattern of almost self-censorship, but it was really Lord Cameron that was the first one to take a strong stance.
And you would hope that David Lammy would continue in that spirit.
Yeah, of course, yeah, because it is just the right thing to do.
Are you disappointed that he didn't find time to see you before he went on this trip? Because I think I'm right in saying you've been requesting a meeting to discuss your father's case for some time, well, presumably since the change of government.
Yeah, so obviously I would like to see him, and how important the case is to us as a family, but more importantly to his captors. It tells them that the United Kingdom government is looking at this matters, and that consequences to treating one of our citizens this way. You know, all politics aside, it's about saving my father's life.
We talk a lot in this country about respect for the rule of law. Do you think China is respecting the rule of law?
Hong Kong, even going back 5 years ago, had a very robust legal system, rule of law. And then the national security law came down. Now Hong Kong has 1,800 political prisoners. When we say political prisoners, it's pro-democracy campaigners. My dad campaigned for democracy peacefully. His only crime was that he had a pro-democracy newspaper. And these are the people that are in jail. These are the people that are being ripped away from their family. The rule of law in Hong Kong is gone. And anybody, any pretense that is still there is absolutely ridiculous.
Are you then surprised or disappointed indeed that some British judges continue to sit in Hong Kong courts?
Yeah. I am disappointed. Lord Sum Shin, who was sitting as a judge in the Court of Final Appeal, when he left Hong Kong, he said, look, it's no longer a place where, in all good faith, I could keep being a judge.
Would you like other judges to reconsider continuing to sit in Hong Kong in the light of cases like your father's?
By sitting in the Hong Kong court, they're giving the Hong Kong legal system a fig leaf of due process. Saying that, though, it's one of those situations where, like with the emperor with no clothes, where the rule of law is no longer there. The thing at stake is not only their reputation, but the continued persecution of the people of Hong Kong. So they must decide whether they are happy to keep walking on top of all these pro-democracy campaigners, or they leave as many of their colleagues have done.
Sebastian Lai. One reason why the US presidential contest appears statistically tied is that Donald Trump is doing better among all working class voters, regardless of ethnicity, than he did when he lost the election to Joe Biden in 2020. A recognition of the need to win those voters back may explain the new industrial policy Democratic Party presidential candidate Kamala Harris is launching at a workers' union hall in Michigan tonight.
We must and we will invest in the industries that built America, like steel, iron, and the great American auto industry. And we will ensure that the next generation of breakthroughs, from advanced batteries to electric vehicles, are not just invented but built right here in America by American union workers.
Well, her team may have in mind voters like those in rural Kentucky, once prosperous coal country, now among the poorest congressional districts in the whole of the United States. That's where the sociologist Professor Arlie Hochschild, author of the highly influential book Strangers in Their Own Land, did research for her new book about white working class American voters who feel their country has left them behind. It's called Stolen Pride. And Professor Hochschild began by telling me about the town she based herself in, Pikeville.
It's in the congressional district, Kentucky 5, that is the whitest and second poorest district in the whole country. And it used to be Democratic, and now 80% of voters in the last two elections voted for Donald Trump. And I went there to discover why.
And one of the factors is that very loss of wealth, success, a sense of pride, which forms part of the title of your book.
That's right. And, you know, we usually start with external forces, globalization, automation, loss of coal, rise of natural gas, migration flows. But those kinds of external forces exacerbate prosperity divides, you know, between urban and rural, blue collar and white collar. And it exacerbated the kind of feelings of loss and failure that a lot of people in this region felt. They used to be very proud. We kept the lights on. We won World War II. Now the jobs were gone. Opiate crisis had come in. And people felt bad and they blamed themselves. So in a way, that became an opportunity for charismatic leaders to kind of speak to that shame.
I suppose it's for all of us, if we have a sense of having failed at something, to try and find someone else to blame. Is that partly what voters have done in a place like that part of Kentucky?
Yes. Like many of us, shame is painful. But it can also function as a nose ring for politicians who aren't really offering them anything better outside of alleviating their shame.
So that's one of the things you think Donald Trump has done?
Exactly. First of all, they're in what I would call pride paradox. They kind of think, look, if I succeed, that's credit to me. If I fail, I should feel ashamed. Trump, I think, has an uncanny sense of shame. I think he's kind of a shame guy himself, which would be neither here nor there, except that it's made him able to really understand pain of shame and to promise to alleviate it and turn shame to blame. And I think it comes in these four moments. Moment one is Donald Trump says, Asian immigrants are eating your pet cat or dog. In moment two, the punditry shames Donald Trump. You can't say that, or it's a lie. Moment three, Donald Trump poses as the victim of the shamers. Look, they're after me. Don't you, my followers, kind of know what it's like to be criticized? I'm taking the hit for you. And in moment four, Donald Trump roars against the shamers. He is a protector of the shamed. So I think we need to stand back from this shaming ritual, ask why it has the power it has, so that we can speak to them in a way they can hear.
Do you think then that Kamala Harris is in a disadvantaged position because she doesn't appear so far to hit those buttons? She's campaigning at a union hall in Michigan today, talking about the $1 trillion+ that have been committed to manufacturing and infrastructure under this administration. Is it because that message just isn't the right message right now?
I think it's the right message, but it should go together with I get how you feel. I talked to a guy who said, I'm trailer trash, okay? I'm white. I've never left this place. I'm disabled. I didn't get a good college education. But I don't feel seen by the Democrats. If I want to feel proud, how do I do it? If you're middle class and white, people say, well, good for you. You worked hard. You got there. Feel proud. If you're black and you're poor, people say, well, you're poor because of racism. But what if you're white and you're poor? There's no narrative for me. I must deserve being poor.
And Donald Trump is a politician who has given somebody like your man who calls himself trailer trash a sense that he isn't to blame because he happens to be in the situation he's in now.
Yes, this particular guy that I spoke to, he said, I don't like Donald Trump. He's a very angry, self-centered guy. But on the other hand, I don't feel drawn to the Democrats. So the Democrats have a job to reach out to men like that.
There is less than a month to go until Election Day. I wonder if you think it's possible for them to do that, given perhaps how they haven't really started thinking about this early enough.
It may be that that's true, but I also feel the issue of reproductive rights for especially women and especially young women is huge. And I think that the Democratic campaign is focusing on the youth vote, and rightly so, and that focusing on the people I write about is a long-term project.
And so you're talking about beyond this election, these problems are not going to go away.
Exactly. Whoever wins, this problem is still there.
That's Professor Ali Hochschild. Now, just how hot do you like it? And if you think I'm being saucy, you're right. Sales of hot sauces rose by 55% last year compared to the year before. That's according to food retailer Waitrose. Plenty of celebrities have spotted the trend and are selling their own branded sauces, or perhaps are themselves part of the reason sales have boomed. Ed Sheeran led with his Tingly Ted range. And now Brooklyn Beckham has launched his own range, Cloud 23. $14.99 a bottle for that one. Eye-watering in more ways than one. Now, I have a confession to make. I'm a hot sauce virgin. Never touch the stuff. So Jen Ferguson, who runs Hot Burns and Black, which sells in its shops and online all things hot and beers and wine to cool your throat down afterwards, is in the studio to show me what I've been missing. Jen, thanks so much for coming in. Just before we do this taste test, I say nervously, tell us, is it your experience that sales have gone up a lot?
Absolutely. So we have seen just phenomenal sales. We've been in this business. We're celebrating our 10th anniversary next month. So we've had 10 years of slinging hot sauce. And we, last year saw 94% sales increase for hot sauces. Christmas time was 150% up on 2022. And this year shows no sign of slowing either. We're looking at 35%, I think, so far. So, it's going a bit crazy.
Now, you've brought in three bottles for me to try. This one first is called Deptford. Is this a mild one? I hope it's a mild one to start with.
I think my palate's probably a little bit jaded. For me, it's not that mild. Sorry, not that hot, but you can be the judge of that.
Right, hang on. It's a sort of orangey colour. Hang on a second. We put it on a crisp. No, that's hot. That's hot. It's not too hot, you're right.
It's not too hot, and I think the chilies that it uses, it's yellow habaneros, so the heat is immediate, but it kind of subsides quite quickly. And you've got a lot of fruit in there as well. So you've got passion fruit, you've got pineapple, you've got mango, and the sweetness tempers the heat a wee bit. So it's a kind of quite horribly named trend called swicy, a nasty portmanteau of sweet and spicy. So I didn't make that up. You'll find...
Next one. Now... This is Jock's hot sauce. I'm tempted to ask who Jock is, but this is not as mild. This is a darker colour. I mean, one quick thing I ask you while I try this one is, there's a risk, isn't there, with hot sauces that we're just losing our palate for flavours?
Possibly. I think we sell a lot of super hot sauces, but I think for the most part, people...
Blimey. Sorry.
I'm enjoying
it. Carry on.
Yeah, I think for the most part, people want sauces that are full of flavour, medium heat, that they're not going to be destroyed after a couple of drops. They want something they can sling over their meals, something that's versatile, adding a little bit of flavour.
I'm going to need a slurp of water at this point, Jen. Hang on. Ooh. Let me say about that one that's still in the back of my throat. And so I'm slightly hesitant with this last one because you did warn me. There's a scale for heat. This last one, which is called Experience with a capital X, where is it on the scale of heat?
So this one sits at number 10. If you've ever seen the YouTube series Hot Ones, where celebrities eat 10 sauces ranging in heat, this is the last one.
This is
it's
a
called The Last
Dab,
and this is a lot of sauce you're putting on that crisp there, Sean.
Right.
I'll take over for the rest of the show if we need to.
Fortunately, Jen is a former radio host in her native New Zealand, so she's perfectly qualified. Right, in the last half minute or so, I'm going to just try this.
So it's called The Last Dab, and it may be the last thing we ever hear from Sean.
You said there's a kind of 1,000, and that's 2 million on this scale.
That is 2 million plus.
Oh, I think this is the one. I may still be tasting this at breakfast tomorrow. Jen, last word. Do you think celebrities, are they making a difference to these sales?
I think the Hot Ones show certainly is. Whether Brooklyn Beckham is going to have a career in hot sauce making, I don't know.
The end of my tongue feels like it's on fire. That's The World Tonight. I'm supposed to be broadcasting on the World Service tomorrow morning. I think the boss may be getting a call. Good night.
I'm Lucy Hockings from the Global Story podcast, where we're looking at disinformation online and its potential influence on the upcoming US presidential election. Why people fall for online conspiracy theories and what happens when real-world events are shaped by online disinformation, and how AI could affect the result of next month's election. The Global Story brings you unique perspectives from BBC journalists around the world. Find us wherever you get your podcasts.